From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, we witness the power of a New York Times columnist. 3 weeks ago, Thomas Friedman floated a trial balloon to break what he called the Israeli-Palestinian impasse. He proposed that Israel withdraw to its pre-1967 borders and allow the creation of a Palestinian state in exchange for full diplomatic relations with its neighbors. 2 weeks ago, he said Saudi's crown prince told him over dinner that he had the same idea. This week, other Arab states are lining up behind the plan, and a serious debate is underway in Israel. Diplomacy by newspaper proxy. We called up Les Gelb, now head of the Council of Foreign Relations, a former New York Times reporter and op-ed page editor, as well as a former official in the U.S. State and Defense Departments. We asked him if Thomas Friedman helped or hindered the peace process. Helped, said Gelb, but Friedman should have said more.
Friedman was perfectly within the bounds of proper column writing. The Saudis were well within their diplomatic rights to play the game they did. But then, in the end, it's up to the journalists to provide the context, namely, why were they doing this? Why was he saying that to me? The context is not that the Saudis woke up one morning and have discovered that they should be the great peacemakers of the Middle East. The context is that the Saudis' position in the United States has been eroding quite seriously since September 11th. So I think the Saudis were looking for some way to put the brakes on that. And no better way to do that than to seem to be participating in the peace process.
Now, the Boston Globe in a column this week said that this isn't the textbook way for diplomacy to be conducted.
Well, it is a textbook way. And very often journalists are chosen by government officials to deliver ideas or proposed compromises or deals in a low-cost or no-cost fashion. If the official presented the idea to an official of the other side, then that idea is on the table. You've already paid the price. If you pass it through a journalist, you have deniability.
Do you expect Thomas Friedman to chime in again on this, or is he going to step aside and let the process work?
Well, I hope he chimes in. He's a real expert on these negotiations.
So you don't think it's inappropriate for him to be interposing himself periodically in this discussion?
Barbara Walters, some years ago, interposed herself between a warring Israel led by Menachem Begin and a warring Egypt led by Anwar Sadat, and got them for the first time to talk to each other through her.
It's interesting because we spoke to Ted Koppel, who raised that very issue, and he says that he finds this journalism-fueled diplomacy to be entirely inappropriate and antithetical to the mission of journalism.
If you're doing straight news, I think that's so. If you're a columnist and you're dealing in the world of opinions and people understand that this goes well beyond the news, I don't think it's inappropriate at all, nor do I think it was inappropriate for Barbara Walters to stage that meeting between the Egyptian and Israeli leaders.
Well, what about you, Les Gelb? You were a foreign affairs correspondent at New York Times, and you've conceded that you were used by the administration once or twice to get some messages out.
And by foreign governments. But every time it was clear they were using me as an intermediary, I made clear in the column, if I were writing a column or otherwise, that this was a trial balloon being floated. And the reader has to be let in on the game.
Well, what about you on the other side of this? One of the reasons why we called you is you are also an assistant secretary of state. You've also worked in the Department of Defense. You also worked for a senator. When you were tapping reporters to float your trial balloons,
right,
would you have preferred that perhaps they used less full disclosure than you currently recommend?
Sure. You prefer less disclosure because when you sit down at the negotiating table the next day or week, you can say in diplomatic parlance, well, you know, that's an idea floated in the newspaper.
Well, thanks very much.
Okay, Brooke.
Les Gelb is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, former New York Times reporter, and former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs.
Sometimes it seems that being a columnist may actually shrink your influence, even at the Times. Columnist Nicholas Kristof, freshly elevated from the paper's reporter's ranks, recently filed a series of columns from the Philippine island of Basilan. There, a gang of about 80 criminals called Abu Sayyaf is being targeted by the U.S. military as a terrorist group. This following a series of assassinations of suspected members and other civilians by local militias. Kristof's op-ed pieces have been chilling, but largely unnoticed or at least unfollowed up on by other news organizations. Nick Kristof joins us now. Nick, what about the Bush administration? Any word from them?
No, there's been a tremendous amount of quiet from them on that. There was a certain amount of a stir in the Philippines, and I heard privately from various people in government or in the military, but I haven't heard any kind of official comment on it.
Well, you know, you're a very good writer, and these columns are quite stylish in addition to being appalling. Is there any difference in your approach in writing an investigative column as opposed to writing a fairly shocking story for page one of the New York Times?
What is different and what I found kind of awkward to get used to is just this freedom to throw in opinions. You know, especially at first, I found that each time I was writing, I would kind of more or less write a news analysis. The New York Times, we call them Q-heads. And, you know, there's a sort of established pattern of doing something that's a little more edgy than a news story. And so I would do kind of a news analysis, and then I'd show it to my wife, who's also a longtime foreign correspondent here, Cheryl Woodun, and she would say, you know, but Nick, this isn't an opinion piece. There's no opinion here. And I would sort of look up and grimace and then go back and, you know, throw in some more opinions. And I found that it really took some getting used to move from the neutrality of, you know, news journalism to this incredible license to say what we think on the op-ed page.
Well, I don't ask the question for no reason, and this is strictly my view, but the injection of your opinion in a funny way actually reduced the story's impact for me, because had these been news stories, they're so appalling on their face that it's like government death squads are bad. I get that.
I mean, I take your point that in the column where you had a young man who was tortured and executed by government troops, who we are now giving extra firepower to, then there's not much need for kind of extra commentary on it. It kind of speaks for itself. I mean, fundamentally, stories are broken mostly on the news pages. Occasionally, it happens on the editorial or op-ed pages. I must say that the constraints I found in this case were not just the issue of length, and I suppose page placement. I mean, it's always nice to have a story on page one, but also art. If this had been a regular news story, then we would have had photos. Indeed, I had photos of the man who was killed, a before photo, as well as some more grisly postmortem photos. Then often it was my experience that what really brought readers into stories about remote places was the art as much as the writing.
Well, I guess where all this is leading is, I think most, for many, many print reporters, the idea of someday becoming a columnist just seems to be Valhalla. And I'm wondering if the New York Times is the one place on the face of the earth where to get an op-ed column, especially the sort of column that you're writing, is actually an invitation to more obscurity.
I don't think so. I mean, I must say, I do have to pinch myself an awful lot of mornings, you know, when I realize the real estate that I'm given, the license to go and dig and to draw conclusions and to put them on the op-ed page. And it's as good a job as I've ever had at the Times.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nick Kristof is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times.
And now a few of your letters. There was an enthusiastic response to our piece on World Business Review, a business program hosted by Al Haig that airs on many public TV stations. Our investigation exposed the show as little more than a 30-minute infomercial.
Greg Peverell Conti of Natick, Massachusetts wrote, "As a PR person, I can tell you straight out that we do not view World Business Review as a legitimate outlet. I've been around long enough to know that serious broadcast journalists do not call tech companies or PR people soliciting stories for a fee. World Business Review does, but it is only one of several that makes similar paid content. My rule of thumb is that if it is produced in Florida, stay away." Barbara Sloan of Alpharetta, Georgia, herself used to work in what she calls the paid programming scene, but was disheartened to see this type of show on public television. "I know it's just the way all media is going," she writes, "but if you can't believe an incredibly boring show on PBS is based in honesty, what can you watch on TV and really believe?"
But Nazar Khodorovsky of New York City said he found the segment, quote, "disgusting. Apparently, for you folks, anything on PBS that is pro-business and does not sound like advanced nateritis is anathema and should be ostracized. Isn't PBS supposed to be an open forum for ideas of all kinds? Why then should corporate views be excluded? General Haig's show gives underprivileged audiences who cannot afford cable the chance to see interviews with CEOs. If that's not public education, then I don't know what is."
Dan Mulford, also of New York, wrote that he was shocked to hear that, quote, "right after lambasting Al Haig for his deceitful shenanigans and undisclosed relationships, you featured a report on Olympic figure skating coverage. Your commentator was introduced as an expert on figure skating. That may be, but you failed to mention that she is also an assistant to the president of WNYC, the producer of your program. Don't you think that that fact is relevant to a piece airing on WNYC? No, not really.
Please send your reactions to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Coming up, Fox News crosses the pond and makes waves. Also, lessons on how to feed the media beast.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The British, long accustomed to TV news delivered with metronomic precision and compulsive observance of political impartiality, suddenly can enjoy a new experience. Just a few weeks ago, thanks to the 300-channel miracle of digital satellite transmission, the UK has had access to the Fox News Channel and all the stridency, theatricality, and conservative politics that come with it. Critics are concerned that Fox will influence the highbrow traditions of British TV news. But in addition, says Ian Hargreaves, director of the Center for Journalism Studies at Cardiff University and media columnist for the Financial Times, Fox may actually be violating British law.
The mainstream culture of news broadcasting in the United Kingdom is that it has to be politically impartial. That is written into the law. It's written into the charter of the BBC, and it's written into the terms of regulation that apply to every commercial broadcaster that is licensed to transmit in the United Kingdom.
Now, you said that in your piece that the arrival of Fox heralds some sort of alarming future. Why do you suppose that is?
Because Rupert Murdoch is very skilled at seeing his way through and round regulation. The great bogey fear is that this highly partisan type of news is going to overturn a long tradition of impartiality in British television news, because it may turn out that the public likes it.
How is it that Fox News Channel and Al Jazeera, for that matter, have been able to legally maintain the transponder time on this satellite without being somehow shut down or challenged in court?
My understanding is that there haven't been any complaints yet, but the thing's only been on air for a few days. And it may be that there will be complaints. It may be that there will be a challenge. But the regulator may take the view that the test of impartiality, which should be applied to an analogue terrestrial television news service viewed by 25-30% of the audience, is rather different from the tiny, tiny audience that any all-news channel is going to get on digital satellite.
Ideological and pugnacious journalism is certainly not a new phenomenon in England. The newspapers there are, by American standards, actually extreme in their degree of shrillness, in their partisanship, and so forth. In that sense, do you think that the Fox News Channel is just offering up a televised version of what English news consumers have been accustomed to for their lifetimes?
Rupert Murdoch is the biggest owner of national newspapers in Britain. His papers have more than a third of the market. The provocative, telling it like it is up yours sort of headline is normal fare in British tabloid newspapers. And there have been attempts before in Britain to create what is sometimes called tabloid television, but they haven't so far been very successful.
All right, Professor, I want you to take off the cap and gown for a moment and become a media columnist for me. How will it strike you if these values that you've described, these rougher, ruder, livelier values, actually wind up infecting, let's just go all the way here and say, the BBC?
I wouldn't condemn it out of hand, as you may expect me to, because it may be that broadcast news has to change in order to engage with an audience which is not reared on the monolithic solemnities of the BBC, but which is used to a rougher, more diverse world coming at it through the World Wide Web and 300-channel, 400-channel television.
Well, I'll tell you what, in 5 years, when the BBC has become talk radio with pictures, we'll give you a call and see how you're liking it. Ian Hargreaves, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Ian Hargreaves is director of the Center on Journalism Studies at Cardiff University and a media columnist for the Financial Times of London.
When Canadian media giant CanWest bought the Southam publishing chain, including the National Post and more than 135 other newspapers last summer, it was described as the largest media deal in that nation's history. CanWest, once seen principally as a TV company, suddenly was having an impact on editorial boards across the Great White North. Last December, CanWest issued a new policy that required all of its 14 major metropolitan newspapers to run the same national editorial each week, sent directly from the company headquarters in Winnipeg. The policy also states that the national column may not be contradicted by unsigned editorials written locally at those papers. That's about the time when Stephen Kimber, former editorial writer for the local Halifax Daily News and director of the University of King's College School of Journalism, quit.
I began to recognize that there were certain stories we couldn't cover, or I couldn't write about in my column. You could not write something positive about the Palestinians or something negative about Israel. You couldn't write a particularly negative column about Canada's prime minister. You also couldn't criticize any of the CanWest's editorial policies or management policies.
So how did you respond? Were many of your columns rejected, or did you find yourself self-censoring?
It was a bit of both. At first, I discovered these areas you couldn't write about by writing about them and being told that those columns were a no-go or parts of columns were a no-go. After a while, you sort of do begin to censor yourself. And then I began to recognize that, you know, I was in a good position to actually take a stand. So what I decided to do was to write a column which directly confronted the issue of censorship by CanWest of its columnists and writers. And, of course, that was the column that they rejected flat outright. And at that point, I decided I had no choice but to quit.
Is the idea of newspaper owners influencing the editorial pages really so unheard of? Don't owners usually determine the editorial voice of their papers?
They do, and I don't have any problem with them having their point of view in their newspapers. That's certainly not an argument that I would make. I think what's happened in this country anyway was that it was a kind of unspoken understanding that as the newspapers became more monopolistic, that they would recognize not only that they had power, but that they had a certain responsibility, a community responsibility too, to allow for the expression of different opinions.
Let me just quote David Asper. He was responding to what he called the bleeding heart critics in the journalistic community with some coined lyrics from the pop group REM. He said, "It's the end of the world as they know it, and I feel fine." He can say that. He owns the company.
He does. And, you know, one of the things that I think is difficult in this country is that there are so few alternatives. Just to outline very briefly what they own, 14 major metropolitan daily newspapers in every city except Winnipeg and Toronto, the National Post, the National Global TV Network, these 126 other newspapers, Canada.com, which is the third most popular internet site in the country, six digital TV channels. It is a massive empire. And if somebody says, well, fine, I quit and I'm going somewhere else, then they look around and say, where else do I go?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Stephen Kimber, former columnist for the Halifax Daily News, but still director of the University of King's College School of Journalism in Halifax. And now we turn to Murdoch Davis, who oversees editorial and news gathering functions for the Southam Publishing newspaper chain owned by CanWest. Welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
So we just spoke to Stephen Kimber about the controversy over CanWest's national editorial policy. He says the national editorial policy limits the number of viewpoints and ideas that can get voiced in Canadian papers. Would you say that's true?
No, I wouldn't. The only thing we have said is that within the editorial column itself, which is, you know, people must recall, traditionally that is the publishing company space, and within that column, on what I've called the core positions we take in these editorials, we don't want to say one thing one day and another thing the next day. But elsewhere on those pages, in signed pieces, op-ed pieces, guest columns, freelance columns, columns by the editors-in-chief themselves, there is absolutely no constraint on what people can express.
He said that there were certain points of view that really couldn't get expressed freely in the papers after they were taken over by CanWest. Those concerning Israel and Palestine were a couple he mentioned, and those concerning the policies of CanWest.
Well, let me take the second point first. Yes, we have said that we are not going to have members of our staff or freelancers or other contributors, you know, using our pages to argue with the decisions of senior management of the company, and certainly not to mischaracterize them, which is what Mr. Kimber did in the column he submitted.
What was inaccurate about Stephen Kimber's column?
Oh, well, we're talking about a column from a couple of months ago. I'd have to go back and reread it. But he certainly characterized our policy as if it was going to constrain the viewpoints that could be expressed by other individual contributors, including himself. And that was 180 degrees wrong. There have been times when we have put out a national editorial and then simultaneously commissioned from somebody a piece to express a contrary view. You know, we're not trying to be Johnny One Note here.
What about on other issues, such as, say, Israel and the Palestinians, as we mentioned earlier?
The only thing that we have said to our editors and our publishers and our staff generally on Israel or any other topic is that in order to be fair comment, any opinion has to be based on facts. You have a little bit of a different standard in the United States, but this is actually, you know, embraced in Canadian law.
And so are you saying then that there has been no pressure on editorial or commentary writers not to address certain issues in a way that would run counter to the central office at CanWest?
No.
Prior to this new policy, the individual newspapers had the right to determine pretty much what their unsigned editorials said. Why was this decision made to have a unified voice?
Traditionally, when a new proprietor took over a newspaper, if they wanted to influence what was said in the editorials, they basically, you know, shot the editor and got a new one. I think we've taken a much more open and above board approach. These editorials, when they published, are clearly identified as national editorials from Southam News. They are not camouflaged or disguised as the newspaper's own editorials. We are not leaning on the editors to, you know, say what we want to have said.
It sounds that you are saying, though, that in the unsigned editorials that are the purview of the individual editors, they aren't allowed to contradict the national editorial.
No. My point is that the unsigned editorials are not solely the purview of the individual editors. The editorials express the publisher's point of view.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Murdoch Davis is Vice President and Editor-in-Chief of Southam News, the newspaper chain owned by Can West.
Large companies, Enron, let's say, typically hire public relations people to cultivate the media. Smaller businesses don't always have that option and often find the media an intimidating force. In New Mexico, the Greater Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce recently organized what it called the Feeding the Beast Tour to show smaller companies how to manage the media. On the Media's Paul Ingalls went along for the ride.
My name's Wendy Forbes, and this is our first annual Feeding the Beast media tour.
This day begins with about 40 small business and nonprofit professionals crowded into a tiny conference room at the Greater Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce. One runs a tree-free paper company. Another represents state cattle ranchers. There are reps from a bank and a technical school. A bus will be taking them to a local TV station, a radio group, and the daily newspaper headquarters to meet some of Albuquerque's media gatekeepers.
Good morning. How's everybody doing?
Good.
Hey, all right. You're lively. I'm not going to have to do that again. That's great.
But first, a presentation from Tom Garrity, who spent 10 years in TV news shops before opening a PR firm. He tells the group to build relationships with reporters before their businesses need coverage and never call close to deadlines. And if you're being interviewed, he says, use phrases that will ensure that the soundbite you want will make it to the final story.
Things like, this is important because, what's important here is, because when a reporter goes back, they're going to be whistling, you know, kind of blowing through in an edit bay, just kind of listening for key things in the interview. And if all of a sudden you say, you know what's important here is, and all of a sudden they're going to perk up, go, hey, I need to listen to this. This is important for me.
Then it's on the bus over to KRQE-TV, the local CBS affiliate. Terry Stewart, who's on the tour representing a large medical lab, tries Tom's tip out on me, saying it's important for her to learn how to get the lab into a news story, where an appearance by a lab expert is more credible than an advertisement.
From a PR standpoint, we're trying to educate the general public about what we are. So if they see in the news media, you know, here's another scientist from TriCorp explaining what hantavirus is, that they see us as that expert.
Keith, can you give me a live box on the CG?
Okay, this is the control room for all the live programming that we do.
In the catacomb-like KRQE studios, Creative Services Chief Marilyn Painter leads the tour. When one of the business people asks where the fax machine is, another tour member jokes, it's probably right next to a big trash can in the newsroom. Marilyn smilingly denies that and says if they'll call her, she'll help improve their chances for airtime.
Sometimes we get calls and people want us to cover, they've got a fundraising banquet. Well, viewers don't really want to watch people eating their food. You know, it just needs a real visual component. If it's good visuals, it's going to, you know, have more interest for news just because we're trying to keep the viewers watching.
On News Radio 770 KKOV.
Next, it's on to Citadel Broadcasting with 200 stations in 43 different markets. Its seven Albuquerque stations are crammed into the fifth floor of a downtown office building. Some tour members say they like the one-stop shopping convenience. Citadel Public Affairs Director Art Ortega is telling them his stations are in the people delivery business, and even organizations with no ad budgets can reach those people with public service announcements or by hooking onto a station's promotion. And for the problem of too much media attention, Ortega offers some advice.
When you're answering a question about some negative or some situation in your company that has come up, appoint one person to speak to the media, okay? I mean, absolutely, there's no question. And you let everybody in your organization know that Mary or Fred or whomever is the media spokesperson for this issue, period.
The tour ends at Journal Center, home of the state's largest daily paper, the Albuquerque Journal, and the afternoon Albuquerque Tribune, which is rocketing off the presses. The group watches from an overhead viewing gallery and listens to piped-in audio.
The pressman can adjust the amount of ink.
the position of the plates, and the speed of the press from their control panel.
If you got something that needs covering, God, I hate it when I do this, pick up the phone and call me.
Michael Murphy manages the journal's business coverage, including the twice-weekly section called Business Outlook.
We have, in the Outlooks, try to have a way to say yes to all of you who call in and say, can you write something about us?
Murphy suggests that the business-friendly Outlook sections are the easiest path for free coverage, as its pages advocate for the business perspective in a way the rest of the paper won't.
There was a developer building a controversial Walmart shopping complex. City Desk did that a lot because very political, neighborhood groups upset and everything. We ended up writing some stories about how that developer actually followed the rules, crossing all his T's and dotting all his I's, that complemented that coverage. But it was a business angle that the City Desk was not giving much weight to.
We ask Murphy to comment on a spread from a recent journal local section, spotlighting a visit by the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile at a grocery store. It is, of course, big and colorful. There's a guy juggling little Wienermobiles, a kid blowing a Wiener whistle. The hot dog maker was announcing a kid's jingle singing contest that would merit one lucky school $10,000. Murphy admitted to it being a winning formula for coverage.
Well, God help me. We like TV, do like a good visual. And if you got your Wienermobile coming in, we're going to go take a picture. And if it's a groundbreaking, we probably aren't. We'll write about it. But you get us a good visual, and sometimes that's better than a 30-inch long story.
So if Wienermobile equals good media coverage, perhaps Enron should be calling Oscar Mayer about rental rates on its Wienermobile. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
Coming up, the tug of war over presidential papers and video schmoozing in a New York bar.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Historians will note November 1st, 2001, a day that will live in infamy. Not for the public, really, just for historians. On that day, George W. Bush signed Executive Order 13233, effectively bypassing the Presidential Record Acts of 1978 and denying scholarly access to 68,000 pages of the Ronald Reagan Archive. The order says that a document can be withheld from the historical record if it is a violation of confidentiality. Who gets to make that judgment? Any of the following parties: the president in question, the president's vice president, the current president, and any family member that the former president designates in the event of his death or incapacity. Earlier this week, On the Media's Mike Pesca attended a conference at New York University where historians and archivists discussed the effect of the Bush executive order.
Bush's order wasn't the kind of action that will get the public to take to the streets, but it was enough for historians to take to the op-ed pages. In the New York Times, historian Richard Reeves said that with the stroke of a pen, President Bush has stabbed history in the back and blocked Americans' right to know how presidents have made decisions. But before we discuss how the law affects history, it's instructive to consider how history affected the law. For 22 years, John Bradamus served South Bend, Indiana, as a Democrat in the U.S. Congress.
Well, in 1978, we were following up the Presidential Recordings and Materials Preservation Act, which was a response to the arrangement by President Ford, newly installed in the White House, to turn over to Richard Nixon all the papers and tape recordings of his administration and make a bonfire of them.
As chairman of the Subcommittee on Printing of House Administration, which he calls the most inconsequential subcommittee in the U.S. House of Representatives, Bradamus was instrumental in creating the Presidential Records Act. He blocked ex-President Nixon's plan in 1974 to destroy files, including the famous audio recordings of the Oval Office. Washington lawyer and former Nixon counsel Leonard Garment says that Nixon wound up being embarrassed by the tapes not only for what was said, but how it was said.
Private conversations are very, very different from public statements, full of unpleasant, nasty jokes, unpleasant language, epithets, racial humor. I mean, a lot of the debate in the upper reaches of political activity could be monstrously embarrassing if made known.
As Garment sees it, the quality of advice that the president gets will be jeopardized if all his advisors sense that they're characters in future textbooks and dramatizations.
I mean, if everyone involved in the government, people around the president, are on a constant virtual reality West Wing television show, and whatever they say is known or can be made known, it's bound to be a completely false performance. People really can't ventilate their views, and it would be a joke.
That's one of the arguments President Bush gives for not only withholding Reagan's records, but also for not releasing the list of energy companies which advised Vice President Dick Cheney. He also cites a loss of privacy and the threat to national security. Speaking at the NYU conference, John Bradamus said that national security is always the first argument against releasing documents.
The war in Afghanistan, the war against terrorism, will be used by the White House as a cloak to say we don't want any of these records made public because that would endanger national security. These are very familiar arguments.
He also notes that security concerns are taken seriously by archivists. In fact, Columbia University professor and historian Alan Brinkley says that there are still documents in the FDR archive that are unavailable because of national security. As for giving up privacy, which Bush has called the biggest sacrifice of his tenure, Brinkley's sympathetic up to a point.
I think if a president writes, a handwritten note to his daughter, there's no legitimate reason why that has to become part of the public record. When a president sends emails out over White House computers, however, who is to determine what's private and what's public? And I just don't think there's any existing mechanism that's adequate to protect the public's right to access to information that actually is public.
If laws don't force archives open, the public will have to rely on the goodwill of ex-politicians to determine what's appropriate for the public to see. That's fine with Saul Cohen, who is the president of the Rudolph W. Giuliani Center for Public Affairs, the first ever attempt by a New York mayor to establish a private archive. Opponents of the proposed Giuliani archive ask why we should trust Giuliani or the current New York mayor, Michael Bloomberg, who also has oversight, to go through the boxes and remove certain documents before professional archivists get a crack at them. Saul Cohen dismisses those concerns.
I think that's very much a red herring. Our principal critic has told me he thought the amount of documents that might have a privacy aspect is going to be very small, would fit in one folder, etc. If by any chance there's the mayor's son's report card or something of that nature, my understanding from the archivists is they routinely determine the difference between private and public. So I think this is a really non-issue, except by people who have access to grind.
In New York, it will likely be a matter for the courts to settle. In Washington, the issue will probably be decided by Congress. Already in committee hearings, even staunch Republicans have joined Democrats in expressing displeasure with the Bush order. This isn't exactly a triumph of bipartisanship. The Republicans know if the Bush order stands, they'll never get a crack at the Clinton archive. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
On Friday, news lovers got a shock. Reports in the New York Times and the Washington Post that Nightline was falling under the axe of Disney-owned ABC. Launched with Ted Koppel at the helm during the 1980 Iran hostage crisis, Nightline carved out a niche among an affluent older audience. But Koppel himself conceded to OTM last year that it could only have survived in its 11:30 time slot because there the competition wasn't so fierce.
We would have been off the air a long time ago if we were in prime time because our ratings would not have been high enough. At 11:30 at night, they're just fine.
Reports suggest that the show loses too much money to justify its continued existence in tough economic times, and that ABC has been luring David Letterman to fill Nightline's time slot. We've invited TV Guide's Max Robbins to explain the hows and whys of the network's decision. Welcome back to the show, Max.
Hey, Brooke.
Nightline is one of ABC's crown jewels, so is this really just a matter of dollars and cents? Is it actually losing that much money?
In the wake of this news, David Weston, the president of ABC News, in a meeting on a conference call, said that Nightline was actually making $13 million a year. Not only does it make money, but it adds a certain luster to the network and to its news division. You call this a crown jewel. It certainly is. And it's not only a crown jewel for ABC, but a crown jewel of the news business altogether. This is as good a regularly scheduled news broadcast as exists. and they're willing to say goodbye in order to lure David Letterman to the network.
Well, let's talk about David Letterman. He has said, not just now, but in the past, that he did not want to be responsible for knocking Nightline off the air. And he's repeated that claim, but he was told that Nightline was going anyway. Do you think that's true? Do you think if Letterman held back, Nightline would stay?
In a negotiation like this, when you're dealing with a star of Letterman's magnitude, the network that's doing the wooing tells him what he wants to hear. I think Letterman is sincere in saying that. I think that, quite frankly, would ABC jettison Nightline if they couldn't put a proven earner like a David Letterman in its place? I really don't think so.
But they're telling Letterman that, or so it's being reported.
A lot of times, the business of wooing talent is a lot like any kind of seduction, Brooke, and that means sometimes the seducer can be less than honest.
What else did ABC News President David Weston say on that conference call on Friday? First of all, is it a done deal?
Weston did not say that. He said that this whole thing blindsided him as well. And I think that speaks to the diminished importance within the corporate structure of Disney and ABC of news. In the past, when Weston's predecessor, Rune Arledge, was president of ABC News, they would never even entertain a decision of this kind of magnitude without involving him in it and without him there putting up the good fight to keep it from happening.
But some justifying this have said, off the record, that cable coverage and the 24-hour news cycle has made programs like Nightline redundant.
That argument is utter nonsense. The cable news networks do some international coverage, especially CNN, but it is rare that they do it with the kind of depth and breadth that a Nightline will do it. And let's remember, too, I mean, the cable news networks, they have a minuscule audience. When Nightline airs, Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN, their combined audience is still a fraction of the audience that tunes in for Nightline every night.
Which is about
5.5 million people. That's none too shabby.
In fact, that's roughly the same size as Letterman's audience, isn't it?
It is about the same size. The difference is that Koppel's audience does skew somewhat older. And when you deliver an audience, a younger audience, to Madison Avenue, David Letterman's audience is more valuable. But it's very expensive for CBS because not only do they pay Letterman himself more than $20 million in salary, they have to license his show from his production company. I've even talked to people inside CBS that really say it's a loss leader, that they're not making money off of Letterman. This is fuzzy math when you get into the business of network economics because Letterman does give them a great promotional platform. And he is a star. He is a brand name. And those brand names help a network. But the same can be said for Koppel.
So from a sheer monetary standpoint, it isn't a slam dunk that Letterman would make money where Koppel lost it.
This whole deal is far from a slam dunk, at least on the surface. It really seems like there's something else at play here. Who knows? Ted Koppel's been quite outspoken in a forum within ABC News, questioned Michael Eisner, the chairman of the Walt Disney Company, about that company's commitment to news, and that was in the wake of cutbacks about a year ago. Look, corporations take heat when they have news organizations that aren't afraid to rock the boat. If you don't have to do it, why do it? And that may be their attitude, that if they can make as much or more money or a little bit less money with David Letterman and there's no headaches, why not? That may be their thinking.
Well, Max Robbins, thanks again.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Max Robbins writes The Robbins Report for TV Guide.
TV aims to please. It seduces us with sexy images. It makes no demands. It sounds like the perfect date. And that's the premise behind a new hotspot in Lower Manhattan called Remote Lounge. We sent OTM's Jad Abumrad to check it out, and what he found wasn't just a bar, but a laboratory for the ongoing experiment in human socialization in our media-saturated age.
You enter a narrow front room lined with 100 video screens which show 100 different people, or parts of people. Big, goofy, 20-something smiles, piercings, and lots of chests and bottoms. Remote Lounge is the brainchild of Bob Stratton, a technology wizard and one of the three owners. He explains how it all works.
This is a cocktail console here, and essentially what we have here is a monitor on the left and two cameras on top of it.
The images are gathered from cameras atop 40 Jetsons-like consoles sprinkled throughout the bar's two rooms. These are where people sit. Each console has its own TV screen and a variety of oversized buttons.
And you can essentially rifle through any of the 40 live feeds in the bar while you sit here. So right now we're looking at this woman here, and we don't know where she is.
I'd find out later that the blonde woman with the very earnest smile was at the opposite end of the bar, and that her name is Jenny. Had he wanted to pursue the relationship, Bob could have spoken to her on the console's built-in phone, or hit the drink button to have a waitress bring her a beverage. As we watch, Jenny's image jerks around spasmodically, which, I learn, is not a bug. Rather, it is evidence of social competition. Several other consoles in the bar are watching Jenny too, and competing for control over the cameras on top of her console. For example, a few consoles over, a group of coworkers, all guys, have tuned in Jenny and are trying to train the unruly camera on her upper torso.
Okay, what just happened there? This is radio. You're going to have to do your best to explain in a way that doesn't offend our listeners.
We sent a message, and she tried to respond in a rather playful, exhibitionist kind of way.
You're understating it.
True.
That's Howard. He makes video contact with Jenny and gestures for her to pick up her console phone.
Hello, can you hear me? You seem to be rather responsive to our, to the camera, rather.
Where are you located?
The guy with the microphone is going to come over and chat with you now, okay?
Tell him I look 10 times better in person than I do on the screen.
I will as soon as I go back.
Yes, and somebody else is trying to chat me right now.
In a video-soaked world like Remote Lounge, there are only two types of people, the viewers and the performers. Jenny is definitely in the second group. As we're talking, Howard's face disappears from her screen and a moment later shows up in the flesh to introduce himself, but as Alan.
I'm Alan.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So, like, you've had me on camera for, what, the past half an hour, or what?
Not so much myself as it was my colleagues next to me. They could control the other camera as well.
They weren't always on my face. That's the problem.
How does that make you feel?
Tad bit self-conscious, but, you know, I've had a couple drinks, so...
In a normal bar, only the bold few approach good-looking strangers. Here, normal guys like Howard, a.k.a. Alan, do it without a problem. To Leo Frenekes, who's a partner in the bar, this is a testament to the power of TV-mediated socializing. You can take on a new identity, many people here do, you can be intimate with someone while maintaining your privacy, and there is no fear of rejection or commitment. The solution to that is simply to change the channel.
People are able to use the video system as a safety shield that allows them to be more outrageous, more outgoing. You're just able to act out your fantasies through a TV screen.
But oftentimes at Remote, the fantasy screen interaction awkwardly collides with the real-life one, especially if you're, say, trying to strike up a conversation with a virtual someone who turns out to be at the console right next to you. This happens to Howard's friend, Phil.
Hello?
Problem is, Phil can't get his phone to work.
Hello? Is it working? I don't know.
Phil, like most here, prefers to socialize in baby steps. First the video, then a phone conversation. In this case, since he couldn't figure out the phone, he did skip right to step 3 and walk the 2 feet to meet a woman who gave her name as Liba.
Liba's an alias.
Tuned in on Liba's screen is, you guessed it, Jenny.
We were just watching this guy, you know, touching his girlfriend. It's all fun and it's nice.
But for Liba, Jenny's private moment with the guy she just met, splayed indiscriminately on 100 video screens, makes her uneasy. The line between sexy and scary isn't always clear, and at Remote Lounge, she says, it seems to cross over itself.
Like, we're not in control of the camera, and we're not necessarily able to watch ourselves, so it's like, I don't feel that comfortable.
At Remote Lounge, control is checked at the door, literally. A disclaimer reads, by entering, you hereby relinquish your right to privacy, to publicity, and to bring claim against the company. Obviously, this doesn't matter to the people here. The chance to be a video star, even on so small a scale, is worth the price, which amounts to personal privacy and a couple of drinks plus tip. For On the Media, this is Jad Abumrad.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by George Edwards and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Jim Colgan. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. So can I buy you a drink?
Yeah.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.